Hello, my name is Julia Widdup, and I'm an interviewer with What Should I Be? If you'd like to get more information about What Should I Be, please visit our website at www.whatshouldibe.me. We provide complete and free access to a wide variety of interviews spanning many different careers from all over the world. Today, I'm speaking with Tin Rose, and he is a professional volunteer from New Mexico. So, Tin, at what age did you first realize this is what you wanted to do with your life?
I started out as a juvenile counselor in my early 20s, I guess, counseling juvenile delinquents. And I noticed that there were much bigger problems than the individual kids had. I mean, all the problems seemed to have a common base. And I thought that to go on and do something a little bit bigger that might affect a whole bunch of kids all at once, instead of trying to do it one child at a time, was something that I might be better at. I enjoyed the individual one-on-one work is very valuable and important, but it seemed like doing something for humanity in general might be a little bit more satisfying and productive for me personally. So I just went on to start doing other things, working for environmental groups and such.
And what age were you when you took that turn in your life?
That actually wasn't until about 40.
Okay. Yeah. So it was kind of late in life that you really discovered your passion, shall we say.
Yeah. Yeah, really. And now I'm an author, and I didn't discover that until I was 50. So.
And what was the common base of the problems that caused you to make this change, would you say?
Common base that caused me to make the change.
Well, you said that they had their problems had a common base.
There were bigger societal problems that lead to the children's individual problems. So I thought that possibly going after those bigger problems and getting the cause fixed, as opposed to treating the symptom, would be the way to go.
Right.
So that was basically the idea behind it, yeah.
And where did you first start volunteering?
I worked all over the place. Anybody that needed anything. Because that's the... I worked for environmental groups for 20 or 30 years. And then the bigger project started later on with the African Famine Relief one. And that was when I was also working in a juvenile detention center type place. And it was right before in the early 80s there when the USA for Africa and Live Aid and all of that was coming out to help the people involved in the Ethiopian famine. All right. Well, about a year or two before that, there was already some press on this issue. It hadn't grown quite that big, but there was already some press. I think Hugh Downs was on 2020 and first brought it to light, you know, to popular attention through that show. So I'm working with the kids, and we just decided, like, how about we do a little project of our own, get people to donate stuff, and we can have a little yard sale, and we can send the money over to the kids who were starving. So we started, and it just ran us over. I mean, it just got past us. Everybody got so involved in it. The firehouse donated a big extra room they had to store things, that people started donating houses worth of furniture and all kinds of stuff.
Wow. It's
really amazing. And here I'm working with a dozen kids. I think as much as it was like a wonderful thing to know that we were providing food for people who really needed it, to see the look on those kids in the juvenile center that I was working at, was, you know, right up there with that, you know, I mean, it was incredible because these were people who had been told all their lives they weren't any good and you're always causing trouble and you're nothing but a problem and you can't do anything right. And their self-esteem issues were like off the charts. And you had to see them like light up. I mean, really light up when this thing started going the way it was going.
They changed. And,
yeah. They, all of a sudden they turned like from people who couldn't do anything right and were constantly demanding attention because in a negative way, because that's the only way they knew how to do it. And all of a sudden they're starting to look at themselves as heroes and people that are functional and do something productive in the world. And so that by itself, I mean, obviously feeding people who are starving is like the major thing. But that just the reaction of the kids who got involved in the program, you know, was beautiful. And I think that kind of sums up this whole volunteer. Look, what I do is not really a career. It's not for like somebody who's going to get married, have a normal life with the kids and stuff. But to infuse some of this into whatever you do, I think is a notion that will make everything else a person does very much more rewarding, right? Because that common base that we were talking about before, if I had to sum up the problem, it's attachment to self, right? Everybody is so attached to their own little thing, my wife, my kids, my house, my bills, my this, my that, my car, my whatever, you know? And you get a little bit skitsy if your attention is just always on yourself. All the little things turn into big things. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly somebody steps on your toe by accident. It's been shouting and yelling and everybody's all. This is all because your attention is concentrated on your own little individual world like that's the only thing that counts. And when you go out and start giving attention to other people, and realize that they have the right to be happy just the same as you do. And they have the need to be happy just the same as you do. And it's an interdependent world because if everybody isn't happy, there's going to be trouble. And it's going to affect everybody else in the long run. So you think you can insulate yourself from whoever else is suffering, but in reality, if one person's suffering, it's going to affect everybody to a certain extent. So just the getting out of your, whether you end up being a doctor or a lawyer or an Indian chief or whatever, it doesn't really, you know, there's no reason to not infuse some of this spirit of volunteerism, of altruism, of helping other people. Because it's going to make whatever you do richer. What I'm doing is pretty extreme, right? And it might not apply to everybody to actually go out and abandon everything and go out in the street and try to help other people in that particular fashion. But to infuse some of that into whatever you do for a living, I think, is an important thing.
Yeah.
And very beneficial to the person doing it. I mean, everybody talks about, oh, you're giving to these people and they're the fortunate ones. But, you know, very few people, you know, stop and think for a minute. I mean, if they actually did it and started helping people a little bit more, you see how good you feel by being the helper, you know.
And so what would you say is the main thing that drew you to this way of life? You must have had an income to support yourself while you do this.
Not really.
And no?
That's the part I don't recommend to people. And it's really pretty impossible for if you're going to have a normal family life, you can't really completely do what I'm doing. I mean, I traveled around for most of my life and just like slept wherever people were. Luckily, people like what I'm doing. And they let me stay over to houses and they feed me and they take care of me, you know. And recently, my father passed away about 5 years ago and left me some money. So for the past 5 years, I've, you know, actually been able to pay my own rent and have an apartment, which people consider normal. To me, it's a luxury item. I mean, I got my own room here and can hang up my stuff. It doesn't have to stay in the duffel bag while I'm going town for to town for different groups and stuff. So that's, you know, yeah, go ahead and do what I'm doing if you want to consider, like, a place to live a luxury item. But I think it's a little more practical for most people to, like, just infuse some of this volunteerism and decency and, like, getting out of yourself and thinking about the other person a little bit into whatever you choose to do for a living.
Yeah. And how did your education help you with what you're doing now?
Education always helps. I mean, there's no substitute for experiential knowledge. You can go to school, learn from the books, and that's very helpful, especially if you're going into a particular field. I mean, if you're going to be a doctor or an engineer or whatever, you know, I mean, even if you're going to be like a gas station attendant or flipping burgers at McDonald's, you have to be trained for that. And much less for a doctor or a lawyer takes such extensive and long-term training.
Mm-hmm.
It all helps. And anything you can pick up from what you read or what you hear from teachers is going to be helpful. In the long run, experiential knowledge is, there's no substitute for it. So as much as I think that the book learning is important, it's more important to get a piece of paper to allow you to become a doctor or a lawyer when you get into the courtroom as a lawyer, mm-hmm. when you get into where you're treating patients as a doctor, that's where the knowledge turns to wisdom, right? And you know how to do the job and you continue learning how to do the job. So education helped me because I got the knowledge, background information on a number of different things that allowed me to go out into the world and put some of that into practical use.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And especially the education that I studied, a lot of spiritual things, reading the Tao Te Ching and different, you know, spiritual things that gave me this altruistic, that helped trigger this altruistic attitude.
Uh-huh. Okay. And what do you most like about this? What is it you like most about this?
About what I'm doing?
Yes.
I really enjoyed writing the two books that I just wrote. And those I'm going to, you know, sell, and all the profits from them are going to go to sponsor wisdom professionals, because I think we need more wisdom in the world. So beginning with Tibetan monks and nuns, and then you'll go on to sponsor other wisdom professionals. So the author part is really fun. I mean, I'm really enjoyed writing the books and like that kind of concentration and just going over the stories. But it all comes back down to that singular feeling that you get from helping somebody, like the kids did in the juvenile center when they did the project for famine relief. And that's the most gratifying part. I mean, people just don't realize how you always feel good when somebody gives you a present, but not that many folks realize just how good it can be to give someone a present.
Uh-huh. Okay. You know? And who do you consider a wisdom professional? You mentioned nuns.
But Tibetan monks and nuns are the first one that the project, the Fearless Puppy Project, is named after the first book, Fearless Puppy, on American Road. But that's the first people we're going to sponsor. But wisdom professionals, I would say that there's a million different definitions for wisdom, of course.
Uh-huh.
Who's giving it to you. I would say it's someone who realizes that we're all tied together. They're not completely focused on their individual little physical needs. Mother Teresa would be at the top of my list for a wisdom professional.
Okay.
All right. Martin Luther King, people like that, you know. But there are so many wisdom systems. I mean, even South American shaman, very few people know what these guys are talking about. It's basically the same wisdomous knowledge as you would get from a Tibetan monks and nuns, a person like, of course, well-known Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer and people like that. Mm-hmm. These are wisdom professionals. So who we're looking to fund with the profits from the books is anyone who's moving in that direction, anyone dedicated enough to donate basically their whole existence, because it's an all-consuming, it's a mentality.
Yeah.
It's more than a job, it's a mentality. So it's not like you leave it home.
Right.
You know? It is home. So anybody who wants to do that and dedicate themselves to that extent, and of course when you're thinking about peace and wisdom and altruism, the Tibetan monk, you know, Khoras and those people, that it's a wisdom-based culture. So that's why that comes to mind first. But certainly not exclusively them, we just use them as a primary example. But obviously Mother Teresa would be at the top of the list, and people like her and anyone. There's a giraffe society. I don't know if you know this, but there's a thing called the Giraffe Society, and it has nothing to do with the animal. It's recognizing people who stick their necks out, and giraffes have long necks. That's why they call it the Giraffe Society.
Okay.
And if you go to their website, there's just like they go and find hundreds of examples of these kind of people who go out and stick their necks out for the human good. And it's very encouraging that so many of them are children, too.
How
you know, you see like 9 and 10-year-old kids doing lemonade stands to raise money for buying blankets for homeless people. And the next thing you know, other people get involved, and this has become a major business, and there's great things getting done there. And that's another thing. There's a lot of people that are a little bit reticent to get into this stuff because they feel like they're fighting City Hall and nothing will come of it. And so what, one big, you know, what's the big deal? So you help one person. But there's no telling where it can go. I mean, you do one little act of kindness can't be overestimating.
Yeah.
Its importance, because you never can tell how that's going to snowball. And if you go to this Giraffe Society website, you can see right there how somebody just started a little thing.
Uh-huh.
And thought they were just doing somebody a little favor, and the next thing they knew, it just kept growing and growing. Because people have a natural tendency. We don't have as much of an opportunity. We have more of an opportunity with the information we get fed by the news and schools and everything else. We have more of it as always, look out for yourself. Get your own thing going,
mm-hmm.
You know, and forget the other guy. So we always have more of an opportunity, it seems, or we're told we have more of an opportunity anyways, to do something that's going to be more self-centered and beneficial to our little self or family or whatever. But the opportunities out there that people don't stop and think about are endless to be helpful to somebody else.
Right.
I mean, there's always an option to be nicer.
Yeah. You know?
There's always an option to be nicer, and that's simple enough, you know.
What are the things you like least about what you're doing?
What I like least about what I'm doing? Well, every once in a while I look around and say, yeah, my friend's got this nice house and all of this stuff. And I'm 60 years old, still sometimes wondering where I'm going to sleep at night or what I'm going to. I mean, after a while, actually, it's not as bad as it used to be. When I first got started, it was a little rough, but now that I've been doing this for several years, it's people just give you stuff so you can go do what you're doing.
Because they want to support what you're doing.
Exactly. I've got several friends, and they like what I'm doing very much, but they do have regular jobs to go to. There's a wine salesman and another guy that, you know, people that are doing all these different jobs. and they would like to get involved in this kind of stuff, but obviously they're working 8 hours a day and then have to come home. So they help support me to a large extent and allow them. I don't have to ever ask for anything, but it happens. But in earlier years, the part I like least about this was certainly the, like, if you're standing out there hitchhiking in the freezing rainstorm for a couple hours, it's kind of hard to maintain your smile. I mean, it's good practice because you do, after a while, learn that no matter what happens, it's temporary. You know, it's going to pass.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to get too involved. And you also, you know, there are other mental exercises you learn to do standing by the side of the road. A lot of these I got from, you know, studying Buddhism, but and other spiritual techniques and traditions. But you learn that it doesn't help any to get aggravated. It's just non-functional energy, you know.
Yeah.
You stand by the side of the road, it's a freezing rainstorm, you're cold. Well, all right, you can be cold and aggravated and miserable and giving yourself high blood pressure, or you can be cold and wet and thinking about what you're going to do next for somebody else. How next time you're going to bring a little bit of plastic so you can put it over you. Make you look at the clouds a little bit more so you learn more how to deal with life as it is right in front of you, your own personal thing. But you also get to focus more on who to help and what you can do later. You know, you think of somebody that's got greater problems with you. Okay, so I'm standing here in a freezing rainstorm, but there's somebody sucking sand because they got no food to eat.
Yeah.
You know? That's a little bit more severe. It makes my standing in the freezing rain look not so bad, not so smart. I'll try to figure out how to do it again. But now that it's here and this is happening, okay. So in order to get through this, it also teaches you other things. For example, the first person that pulls over and lets you into their car, after you've been standing out in a freezing rainstorm hitchhiking for a couple of hours, you can't start yelling and complaining that, oh, I was just out there. This is the person who's nice enough to pull over.
And you're getting their car all wet.
And they're going to let you in. The last thing they want to hear is you all full of complaints and yelling and screaming about how people left you sitting on the side of the road for 2 hours. So these are all like lessons that the education you learn by putting yourself out there is the experiential knowledge, that stuff you just can't get from books.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not downplaying the book learning. It is very valuable, and there are any number of things that I've read and put to use constantly in life just from reading them, being in the class, and hearing about them. But again, that's knowledge, and that knowledge doesn't turn to wisdom until you get some experiential thing going on.
Yeah. And can you take us through an average week and explain what it's like to be you?
There are no average weeks. There's no such thing as an average week. Today I have 2 interviews and tomorrow 1. Next week I'll be 12 to 14 hours a day on the computer establishing connections for the books I'm trying to sell to raise money for the charity project.
Okay.
Yeah, after that, I may get a call and have to go do a thing in a bookstore a couple of 100 miles away and talk to people there. I may have another week where all of a sudden there's dead spots. Everywhere says we're on vacation, we're not doing anything, and I have to sit there all geared up and waiting to do something, and there's nothing there to do.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't happen often enough. But there are no average moments. I mean, not only isn't there any average week, there are no average moments.
Really?
Everything, again, that's one of the beauty parts about it, actually, is that I'm not going to, it's not as stable and secure, obviously, but it's also more exciting of a life and more interesting if you're not going to this, and I've worked in factories before. You go to the same assembly line, you fold up the thing, you put it in the box. Another one comes down the belt, you fold it up, you put it in the box, fold it up. All right. it's kind of fun. You can get a lot of other stuff done in your brain while you're doing it because it doesn't take much concentration.
Right.
But nonetheless, it can get a little bit dull after 20 years. Whereas this, there's not even a dull moment, much less a dull week.
Because there's not an average or typical day or week. Well, no. Why are you in New Mexico rather than Vermont right now?
Because it's warm and Vermont is cold.
Oh,
I've been doing this for, this is the seventh year now. And since I got my father's money, which is almost worn out, so I won't be doing this forever. But for the last 7 years, I've been able to go back and forth between New Mexico and Vermont. I stay in New Mexico when it's winter and in Vermont when it's summer, because the summers down here in New Mexico are easily as brutal as the winter in Vermont, you know.
Okay.
I
thought maybe you were down there for a specific project or something.
Well, it has been real good because it's a very small town, and I've written two books while I've been here. And there's really nothing to do at night.
So you've been getting a lot of writing done.
Yeah, so it's a perfect place, like being at a writer's colony, you know, something. Because you're just sitting here, and if you go walk down the main street in the town that I live in, it's a lovely little town, but you can walk down the main street at like 7 o'clock in the evening, even 6, no cars, no people, walking from one end of the town to the other on the main street.
There's nothing going on.
Nothing happening, you know? There's a couple of restaurants out going towards the highway and stuff that are open for dinner. But if you're not going to eat out, there's nothing else to go to. So it made for a very good situation for me to do continuing meditation and the writing of the books and all of that and studying up on different things that I study up on. And learn some new exercise programs and learn how to do Tai Chi and different things.
Uh-huh.
But and there's hot tubs here to soak in. But that's about, yeah, there's nothing else going on. So that's basically what I've been doing here is writing the books. And I had to concentrate on that because I'm not an author. Everybody's been raving about the book, so I guess I accidentally...
You are an author.
I guess. I am now. You know, I accidentally wrote a couple of real good books from what people tell me, but my idea was just a funding vehicle for the project. And I figured the odds of selling 1 million books were a little better anyways than winning the lottery. instead of getting lottery tickets, I'll just, you know, write the books and try to sell them. And maybe that'll raise enough money for the project. So.
And what were some of the most difficult and challenging things that you experienced in your journey?
You have to get immune to rejection. You have to be very firm in your own beliefs and knowing that this is the right thing that you want to do and that helping people is the right thing to do. And I found that in a number of places. I go around door to door for Greenpeace and some guy would say, save the whales, why don't you save the dinosaurs while you're at it? And they bark at you. And you just got to shut that out. And people are going to think what they are going to think. If I go there to present them with some information, they will either react positively, negatively, or not at all to it. And I can't take that personally. That's the other person is coming from where they are coming from. All right. I've seen so many people go out and try to like go door to door for different groups and they're feeling all noble. Oh, I'm going to save the world. And they come home crying,
mm-hmm,
you know,
because they're being rejected so much.
Yeah. And, you know, if it wasn't the kind of situation that people were so self-centered, they're involved in their own stuff instead of the bigger picture. If it wasn't like that, well, we wouldn't need you to go door to door in the first place. Everything would already be honky-dory, right?
Right.
You go to somebody and they don't care about what you care about, you can't let down that turn you off to it. You know?
Doing what you're doing. What tips or suggestions would you have for someone who's considering doing this with their life?
Stay healthy. Stay healthy. Don't overamp on this, you know, and go crazy with it. It's wonderful to be dedicated, and it's even more wonderful to be totally dedicated. But when you're trying to help every person in the world, please remember that you are one of them.
And you have to take care of yourself.
Yeah, because this martyr thing is way out of style. All right.
Okay.
It's an accepted part of our Western culture that whoever does anything good has to get their butt kicked in some fashion. You know, Jesus got crucified, and people get left out on the streets that are trying to do this kind of stuff. But and people overextend to such a great degree, you know, and work like 20 hours a day, forget to sleep. You're not going to do anybody any good unless you have yourself there intact, all right?
Okay.
I would say to anybody trying to do this type of stuff, I do 3 different sets of exercises and meditations every day. All right.
Okay. Did you ever get unhealthy while you were doing this when you first started, or?
Oh yeah. I learned the hard way.
Okay.
I learned the hard way. You overextend yourself. You go out and think you can do all kinds of things day and night, and the literal burning the candle at both ends, and all of this, and that lasts for a very short period of time until the fact that you're a human living in a body catches up with you. All right? And the mind and the consciousness and the heart of this is what does it all. But if you don't have a healthy body to carry all that around, you ain't going to get anything done. All right? So you got to maintain that health and strength to be able to go out and do this. Also, you're constantly talking to other people, asking them if they do this and that for whatever cause you're going out to. If you're tired, irritable, short-tempered, this is going to do absolutely nothing for your purpose. All right? You have to be in shape enough and calm and collected enough in order to be able to present your case logically to whoever you want to present it to. Because if you start grabbing people by the scruff, and I've seen people do this, how can you be so selfish and violent? And they hit somebody telling them that, how can you be so violent? It doesn't work. I mean, who is it? Gandhi, I think, was the one. And Gandhi's another one, of course, that's right up there at the top of the list with Mother Teresa. He said, you have to be the change that you want to see in the world. So if you want everybody to be calm and more helpful, and you don't react to what somebody else is telling you, you know, you act. Right? You got to be firm in that base. And in order to be firm in that base of knowing, even though it's unpopular, and we're living in a world where a lot of people are just completely self-involved and selfish and want to get the most toys, and even though that's the norm and fear is the norm, if you're coming from a place of love and comfort and wanting to help other people, you have to be real firm in that place yourself, and you can't do it if you're not healthy.
Okay.
I mean, it's a lot more.
So you credit your exercise and your meditation to your being able to stay stable like that and grounded?
Yeah, it helps very much.
And what kind of exercises do you do each day?
I do yoga, stretching, tai chi. There's a thing called Tensegrity that's related to the Carlos Castaneda books. That's the Mexican tai chi-ish kind of program.
Uh-huh.
And Mexican sorcerer, they call whatever. But it's another very similar to tai chi kind of exercise program. And a lot of the things I do are slow movements that just kind of get you back in your body, which sounds funny, but a lot of times, you know, because people always talk about the out-of-body experience.
Uh-huh.
And always out of our bodies, you know, because our brains are always thinking about the job and who do I got to call and where do I got to go. and how am I going to pay the rent, and what about these blah, 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 and it's all over the place. And when you do that slow-moving kind of exercise, it grounds you, you know.
Okay.
And putting you in your, you know, so then you're actually calm and you're at home within your own skin instead of constantly flitting around all over the place with your brain. You're at home within your own skin, within your own body. And yeah, because the in-body experience is really the secret to all of this, you know. This has been, it's not an original thought. I mean, we've heard this from lecturers for the last 20 years at least. And if you want to go back into ancient texts, probably for the last 20,000 years. But yeah, that grounding is very important.
Okay. And how did you learn to do those? By video or books or?
I actually learned. Pretty much all the exercises I started learning, but now I go to Tai Chi classes and practice with other people as well. But I started learning all of that stuff through videos. There was a period there, and I think it was the early 90s, where PBS was running an amazing collection of spiritual people, and they had all these exercise shows on, as well as like Deepak and Wayne Dyer and Stephen Covey and Marianne Williamson and like just oodles of these people that were doing lectures at the time, especially in conjunction with the PBS fundraising thing.
Uh-huh.
And come on and do the lectures and give the books for a package. So I just watched them over and over and over again, the lectures and the exercise program, and started doing the exercise programs daily. And then when I'd get to a town and I'd see they were having a Tai Chi practice with a bunch of people, I'd go in. So now where I am now, they have it in the senior center. So I go and do the same stuff with the group of people, which is even more fun. But it's kind of fun to do it, you know, myself too. I mean,
yeah.
It gets the job done. It's all about centering, so that you have a centered self in order to bring out to what you're trying to do. Because it's, like I said before, it's very difficult to do anything productive when basically you're not all there inside your own body because your thoughts are all scattered all over the place.
Well, how did you choose the town that you're in? Was there some particular reason you chose?
Yeah, I'm in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, believe it or not. That's the real name of the town. They named it after the old TV radio show, and they did some kind of deal with Ralph Edwards, who wanted some town to name themselves after a show for a publicity stunt. So they did it, and that's the real name of the town, is Truth or Consequences. And I chose it because I was in Vermont and wanted to get out of the winter. And so I wrote, and this was before I had my father's inheritance there, so I didn't have any money at all. And I had worked at hostels before, so I wrote around to like about 20 different hostels in warm places, California, Hawaii, New Mexico. And it turned out that this one sounded best. And I ended up coming here and pretty much never left, at least for winters anyways, you know. For the summers, I tried to get back up north. But for winters, I ended up never leaving this place. It's a cute little town. It's different.
It sounds different. How big is it?
I would say the major, like, real downtown area is about 3 square blocks.
Oh,
and then you got about 2 miles of strip, you know, but that's like a real town. Then you got 2 miles of what America has become. That's what America has been used to, you know, used to. There's real downtown with stores and people that you know in them and stuff. And then there's about 2 miles of strip that goes up to the highway that has all the fast food places and a Walmart at the end of it, stuff like that, you know.
Okay.
Well, so we call the downtown Truth, and the part that goes up to the highway, the strip malls. Yeah.
And can you do what you do from just anywhere? Is it mostly done on the internet?
Well, it depends what phase and what aspect. I mean, what I'm doing now is mostly done on the internet. When I was going around for the environmental groups more, that required a lot of traveling. And some of that is actually described in the Fearless Puppy book there, about going around for the environmental groups. And there I had to go town to town to town to town and travel around. I kind of invented the business canvas system because they had people going to folks' houses in the evenings. And I'm thinking, rather than people in the businesses are sitting right there, and they probably want to help and have no way to get this information because they're not at home when we're around. They're in the business. So I started going to the businesses. It worked so well, they told me to keep doing it. And then I just established my own route, and I would go to travel from town. So I was like in a different town every week, sometimes every couple of days.
Wow. You know,
and be doing that for like the better part of a year.
Did those groups provide a place for you to stay at those towns?
Yeah, most of those groups provided, well, the last group I worked for anyways, Greenpeace actually gave you a percentage of whatever you brought in for contribution.
Oh, okay.
The group I've been working for up until recently is Citizens Awareness Network, and they would provide traveling expenses.
Oh, okay.
Well, stay at a hostel, I could take a bus. I mean, most of the time I hitchhiked anyways, and I stayed at a friend's house. So it didn't cost them anything. But if I had to stay at a hostel or something, I couldn't like stay at a Sheraton or anything.
Yeah.
If I had to stay at a hostel or some cheap old place or take a bus, then they paid for the traveling expenses. And of course, I always had, you know, friends around that I could stay with as well. I mean, after a while, you go to all these towns for a period of 20, 25, 30 years.
You have friends,
You start knowing people, you know, and after a while I became friends with some of the people who own the businesses that I was asking for contribution. But anyways, that was when I was younger and had the legs to do that kind of stuff. Now I sit and write books and try to sell them, and that's pretty much all done by the internet. You know, I imagine eventually I'll have to go around and start doing more book talks in bookstores and, you know, readings and like that.
So are you available to give talks?
Yeah, and we're doing it right now.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, we are.
Yeah, available too. I mean, you know, mostly that would happen in bookstores, I suppose, because I'm an author, people would read the book, and that's a common kind of thing, that if a book gets popular, then they invite the author to the store to do a read a chapter to people and talk about it a little bit. And I've done a few of those over the years, and it's going to start picking up because I just finished the second book, which is called Reincarnation Through Common Sense. So that's, even the title has already caught people's attention without reading the book, but I imagine there's going to be more of those travel to a bookstore to give a little talk kind of thing coming up.
So what is the first book about? The first book was called what?
The first book is called Fearless Puppy on American Road. All right. And you can get some free sample chapters if you want to see what it's like without buying it at the website, which is fearlesspuppy.org.
Okay.
.org, it's not .com. But if you go to that website, there's free chapters there, and that'll tell you something about it. But it's basically about 35 years of hitchhiking.
Okay, so it's the story of your travels and your life, it sounds like.
Right, and a lot of this stuff we've been talking about, and a lot of it that we haven't been talking about. I mean, I left home as a 15-year-old drug dealer in Brooklyn, New York. And I ran away from home and started hitchhiking. And that ran me into all of this other stuff. And so that's what that first book is about, the Fearless Puppy book.
How you went from being a drug dealer to a philanthropist.
Yeah, I was just a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't even a drug dealer as an adult. But, I mean, when you're in Brooklyn, New York, it gets pretty heavy because you're dealing with the police, the ripoffs, and the mob that's doing stuff. I mean, you got to play a whole bunch of different cards a whole bunch of different ways. So it's a little trickier than just being in a small rural town and giving your buddy a bag of weed and taking the money from him.
You know?
So it got a little complex, and it was going to get more complex. I got out of there and just started going and didn't care where, you know. And I ended up with going through enough to make me realize that everybody's got problems, and mine aren't that much more special. My needs aren't any more special than anybody else's. Sure, it's my responsibility to take care of my needs, but it's also, you run into all these people on the road, and it's a pretty common denominator kind of thing. Everybody's human. Everybody wants to be happier. Nobody's miserable on purpose. Nobody gets up in the morning and says, okay, I'm going to be a nasty jackass today, and I'm going to make myself miserable and make as many people, you know. If you do that, it's an illness, you know. And so that actually led, you know, from some pretty ugly beginnings, if I must say so myself, it actually led to a lot better stuff later on. So I don't ever begrudge the experience or complain about it, because you know, that's sometimes you have to go through some stuff in order to get where you're going.
That's what made you who you are today, huh? And what's the latest book about the reincarnation?
It's called Reincarnation Through Common Sense. And that's about a half year that I spent in a temple in Asia. All right. And I don't want to spoil it, you know, but for anybody who's going to read it. But the twist about this book is that I wasn't going there to study Buddhism at all.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I went to Thailand. I was rescued by a bunch of monks and nuns. I had some very bad incidences happen over there. And the monks and nuns practice compassion. That's their full-time job description. So they took me in and said, yeah, we know you're not Buddhist. You're not studying this stuff. It's okay. You just sit here and relax. Make believe we're your family. And the head monk said, I'm like your oldest brother. And the monks and nuns here are like your brothers and sisters. And there's your cabin up there on the hill. And you just relax. You can do whatever you want to take part in what we do. Great. You want to take no part in what we do. Great. There's a beach over there. Go swimming. Do whatever you want. So there are a lot of white boy in an Asian temple books out, but this one is a little bit unusual. It's got a much different twist to it, in that it's not about a person who is going to study Buddhism, which is what all the rest of them are pretty much. Just more or less ended up in that situation, just got lucky or karma, you want to call it, you know. And so that's what the second book is. And there's also a little twist on the term reincarnation, because most people think of it as dying and coming back in another body. And this is what reincarnation means. But there really is a whole nother aspect to it, where it means you get up every morning and have a chance to start a new life with unlimited possibilities. I mean, there's nothing stopping you from getting up in the morning and becoming another Mother Teresa. There's nothing to stop you from getting up in the morning and becoming a sniper from a bell tower either.
Oh, God.
No, yeah. But serious, these are your options, are like from one end of the spectrum to the other. So there is certain Buddhist schools of thought, the idea of reincarnation is not about dying and then coming back in another body so much as it's about realizing that you're actually a new person anytime you have the thought that you are a new person. You hear so many people say, oh, I'm stuck here, and I have to do this, and I have no choice, and there's no such thing. It's nonsense.
Yeah.
You can, at any given, of course, there are consequences, there are repercussions of any action. It's not like there's going to be no reverberation. But the truth of the matter is that at any given moment, you could put those headphones down, walk out, and start picking sick people up off the street and bringing them to clinics. Or you could go out and start get a gun and start putting a bullet in people's heads on the streets. I mean, the options at both ends are open. And that's the reincarnation thing that this particular book is focused on. Hence the reincarnation through common sense instead of through some kind of esoteric belief that there can never be any scientific proof of, because obviously if you're dead, you're not going to tell anybody about the experience of moving into another body.
Actually, some people have, you know.
Some people have, yeah. I wonder where that comes from. I mean, it might be real, that, and it might be, you know, some... I mean, the mind is an incredibly powerful thing.
Right.
Folks ever realize the power that's lurking in there, they do a little bit more to exercise it. And it's possible, nothing's impossible, I don't know, if people actually die and come back in another body and remember it. It's also possible that people put this idea in their heads and then they flash it on the screen afterward.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you have a website?
The website is www.fearlesspuppy.org.
Okay.
All right, and Fearless Puppy is spelled just like it sounds.
Okay, so, and on there you have about that book and also about the new book and...
And about the project that we're doing to raise funds. I mean, the whole, like I told you before, I'm not an author. I never had plans of being an author. The only reason I wrote these books, and it seems they accidentally came out real good because I'm getting great reaction to them, but the only reason I bothered to write to begin with was to fund the project.
Okay, and tell us again about this project you're currently on.
It's to sponsor wisdom professionals. Anybody who is going to like make a full-time commitment to bringing more positivity, more constructive action, more things based on altruism as opposed to selfishness into the world, I think deserves to not have to worry about money while they're doing it. You know, not have to worry about where they're going to sleep and what they're going to eat, you know. That's just, you know, the basic necessities. If it's that kind of person, they're more dedicated to other folks than they are to themselves to begin with.
Right.
All right. So they're not going to be like raking in a whole bunch of shekels, you know, and running around in Cadillacs and with mink coats on, you know, anyways. But when it gets to the point where some of these people, and there certainly are some, you know, monks or Buddhist monks and nuns that I know of that are running around with and don't really have enough to eat every day. And that's if you're going to dedicate yourself to helping everybody else, you should have at least some kind of support system to make that physically viable for you to do without becoming unhealthy. And so that's what the project is about. And that's why I wrote the books, was to, as a funding vehicle,
okay,
for the project.
All right. So that's fearlesspuppy.org.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
The pleasure was mine, Julia. You're wonderful to talk with you.
Okay. Good luck to you and your endeavors.
Thank you very much.